This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Two massive earthquakes hit Turkey and Syria. Thousands of people have perished. When the shaking started, this Syrian man rushed to get his family to safety.
I took my both children and my wife to just try to escape, but I find nowhere to escape.
One lucky story of survival. Also today, the U.S. shoots a Chinese balloon out of the sky. Another round of the two countries pointing the finger and raising the heat.
Each side thinks that it is behaving responsibly, and the other side is the one that is calling for war.
And islands in the South Pacific are trying to chart their own course, finding a path that is neither pro-U.S. nor pro-China.
Pacific Islanders, we are a little bit tired to be pawns on someone else's chessboard.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, we wrap up a Grammy Awards with an international flair. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us. Concern and worry for people in Turkey and Syria, where two powerful earthquakes today have killed thousands of people. Many thousands more are missing. The World's Duri Buscarin is in Istanbul, about 500 miles northwest of the epicenter in southern Turkey.
This is the nightmare scenario. It's 4 a.m., everyone is home and asleep, and from just outside this small border city of Gaziantep, an earthquake measuring 7.8 on the Richter scale just tears across southeastern Turkey and most of Syria. It's even felt as far away as Lebanon, Cyprus, and Egypt. And as far as we know, things are shaking for about 90 seconds. Buildings collapse, a residential high-rise 100 miles away turns to dust, even a hospital wing by the Mediterranean Sea collapses with patients inside. Neighbors are rushing to dig each other out of the rubble in freezing cold conditions, even snow and rain in some places. And then, about 10 hours later, the second one hits.
Unreal and terrifying to begin with, and then this turns into two back-to-back earthquakes.
Right, and the second earthquake is almost as big as the first. It's a 7.5, and it hits around 1:30 in the afternoon, just one province over. Already shaking, already damaged buildings, further damaging roads, even an airport.
What do rescue efforts look like right now?
People are desperately trying to reach survivors. They're trapped under the rubble, and rescuers know they're facing a ticking clock. But rescue crews are spread out over an impossibly large area. The worst damage is spread over 10 Turkish provinces, as well as northern Syria. And even getting to these victims is hard. I mean, there are road closures, multiple airports have stopped flights, electricity and cell service is down in a lot of areas, and it's winter here. It's snowing in some places. The Turkish Disaster Agency, just to give you a sense of this, is asking for donations of blankets, electric generators, warm clothes. I talked to a friend in Gaziantep near the epicenter, and he says everyone who has a car is outside sitting in it right now, trying to stay warm, and in his words, waiting for Godzilla. They've been told not to leave the city because the roads are so badly damaged, and they're scared that these past two earthquakes are just precursors for an even bigger one.
So, Duri, you traveled to this region just a couple of weeks ago to cover a different story for the show, so you've got some situational awareness there. Tell us more about the community where this earthquake hit.
Right. I was in Gaziantep to report on an after-school program for Syrian refugee kids, and this southeastern region has a huge concentration of families who have fled the Syrian civil war. Even other countries nearby, like Iran, a lot of people are Kurdish, and so they've gone through that upheaval in recent years. We also did a story about the area's historic copper industry. It's an old city on the Silk Road. There's a lot of artists there, a lot of really interesting music. Gaziantep is kind of a foodie destination. It's really famous for its locally grown pistachios and kebabs. But if you look at the regions that are damaged in this earthquake, Diyarbakir, Karen Manmarash, Hatay, A lot of people here are part of a minority group. A lot of people live in small towns and villages. They're spread out. It's an incredibly vulnerable population. People don't have a lot of savings to fall back on. They live in homes often that don't have a lot of up-to-date construction. Even though Turkey sits on a fault line, this is the kind of thing that every person who lives in Turkey fears will happen to their city, and this just happened in probably the most vulnerable section of the country.
The World's Duri Baskaran in Istanbul, bringing us the latest news on the massive earthquakes that have struck southern Turkey and northern Syria. Duri, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
The quake also caused extensive damage in Syria. On the southern side of the border with Turkey is the Syrian province of Idlib, home to millions of people displaced by years of civil war in Syria. The World's Shirin Jafari reports on how people there are dealing with the aftermath of the quake.
Abdul Kafi Alhamdo first felt the tremors at around 4 in the morning. His first thought was that it must be another bombing. The country has been at war for more than a decade, and the sound of airstrikes are not that unusual.
But a bombing, it wouldn't last for that time because, the first 2-10 seconds, no, it's still moving, so I knew that it's earthquake.
Alhamdo and his wife scooped up their two kids and started to leave the house.
But I find nowhere to escape.
In the confusion, he says, he wasn't sure if outside was any safer, so they decided to stay inside. Thankfully, their home wasn't destroyed. It was when Alhamdo stepped out to survey the damage that he realized the scale of the devastation.
Hello again, this is Adi Kafi, Alhamdo. In fact, I'm here in Al-Tarib city. I'm here, I'm standing over the main market of the city.
Alhamdo shared this video with me that he shot this morning in one of the nearby cities. Behind him, no structure is intact. There's a large excavation vehicle nearby, but people are seen using their bare hands to search for survivors.
I saw some people who waiting, putting their ears on the rubble, waiting any response from under the rubble to know that their relatives or beloved are still alive.
Later, he shared this video. Rescuers rushed a newborn away from a collapsed building and to safety. Alhamdo says the baby's mother had just given birth in the midst of the rubble. Hospitals in that part of Syria are overwhelmed. Dr. Shajur Islam is an anesthesiologist in one of the hospitals in Idlib.
When I tell you this is the worst I've ever seen, I literally mean that.
Over the past 7 years, Islam has seen a lot of suffering from the fighting. But this is much worse, he says.
We're literally at the entrance of the hospital deciding which patients we're going to try to save, which patients we're not even going to make an attempt to save.
He says they're putting several patients in one bed. They're figuring out who gets a ventilator because they have so few of those. All other hospitals in the area are closed, Islam says, either because of the war or because they don't have the supplies to continue operating. Islam says before the earthquake, they used to send some patients across the border to Turkey to get treatment. They can't do that now.
Unfortunately, because Turkey is overstretched with the amount of casualties they have, they've closed the border. So they're not accepting any of our patients.
An earthquake of this magnitude would be hard for any functioning state to deal with. But this part of Syria is controlled by a rebel group. The Syrian government has fought to take back Idlib over the years, but it hasn't succeeded. Millions of people fled from other parts of the country to Idlib. Jennifer Higgins is with the International Rescue Committee.
These are also communities that have been living in perpetual conflict zones. They've witnessed multiple atrocities, and many of them are really living with life-changing, not only physical, but also emotional wounds. And they've already been displaced multiple times.
There is only one UN-mandated border crossing that is open for humanitarian aid to get through.
The main response for northwest Syria fundamentally moves through this Bab al-Hawa crossing checkpoint.
The vote at the UN to keep that border crossing open was renewed last month, and it's only good for 6 months.
The main amount of medical supplies that are going into northwest Syria are also through this crossing. And we really have to think about the capacity now for that health system to be able to scale up and respond as necessary.
The weather has been cold in this part of Syria. As the sun started to set today, the rescue efforts continued. In videos shared with me, volunteers from the first responder group called the White Helmets turn on their headlamps and head out to try to reach people trapped under the rubble. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Musicians are a product of their environment. Danny Larkin grew up along the contentious Armagh-Monaghan border in the Republic of Ireland, not far from Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK. It's a border that was a hotbed of conflict in the 1970s and 80s during what was called the Troubles. Danny Larkin did not grow up during the height of the conflict, but that dividing line of the border has always made her aware of living somewhere in the middle. That awareness is reflected on a recent recording, Between Worlds. Oh, borderlands and conflict, two things Danny Larkin is well acquainted with. She spoke recently with the world's April Peavy.
Danny was born Danielle Carragher in a small village along the border. It was a time of happy memories.
Being a person that grew up on the border and whose life essentially was filled with family gatherings each week where we shared songs and stories and plays and dancing of any kind each week, that grew into my sense of self, but I didn't know that that wasn't a common experience for everyone.
Because outside her home, sectarian violence was ripping other families apart. The Good Friday Agreement ended the conflict in 1998. It was only later that Larkin understood how divided her area really was.
It's not until I moved away from the border, from the way of thinking in two places at once, you know, to government jurisdictions, to currencies, to practices, although albeit not so differently in terms of law, but to very stark experiences in terms of conflict.
As a way to understand what divides and what unites the Irish, Larkin turned to folklore. Stories with a shared history.
My work is very much rooted to place in the sense of the island of Ireland as a place that belongs to everyone that lives there, that the stories that we've shared over hundreds and thousands of years are accessible.
One of those stories is told in her song, The Red, Macha's Return.
Macha is the goddess of war and transformation in Ulster. It's also the namesake of Armagh, Ardwaha in Irish. So for me, that song conjures, each time it is sung, it conjures magic, it conjures wonder, it conjures myth.
Danny Larkin has since moved away from that contentious border in Ireland, but that doesn't mean she shied away from living in other areas prone to conflict. She's lived in Israel and Colombia. She currently calls Belfast, in Northern Ireland, her home.
In a way, it becomes a comfortable kind of discomfort or a familiar kind of discomfort.
The key for Larkin is to seek beauty.
Grown up in a place where you feel conflict and feel conflicted and feel the hurt and pain and suffering, but also alongside the joy and love and kindness and a willingness to create change, that is something that for me and for other people that I've spoken to at home, we constantly seek out.
Danny Larkin brings her songs of folklore and hope to New York City this week. For The World, I'm April Peavy.
Coming up on the show, a massive Chinese-made balloon floated across much of the U.S. last week. Then the Department of Defense shot it out of the sky this weekend. Just ahead, we'll set aside the airborne spectacle and look at the real consequences for the U.S. relationship with China. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It was one of the highlights of the weekend news cycle. The U.S. shot a large Chinese balloon clear out of the sky.
Boom!
Reaction from crowds there on the ground. Washington says it was a Chinese spy balloon. China says it was a weather balloon blown off course. Regardless of which side you believe, the downing of the balloon may also have ruined efforts to repair U.S.-China relations. David Rennie has been following this. He's the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Rennie told me that Chinese media are downplaying the incident and mocking the U.S. for overreacting.
It is being talked about very, very kind of discreetly, and the argument from the Chinese side to their own people is that America is being ridiculous and aggressive, and that it used a multi-million dollar missile from a hundreds of million dollar fighter jet to down an innocent weather balloon which belonged to a private company, and that this is outrageous and in breach of norms. And they very carefully used their absolute control of the internet to sort of stoke funny memes that sort of show the Americans are being kind of ridiculous and scaredy cat and sort of bullies and thugs and sort of foolish. In fact, I was at an embassy just this evening and met a senior Chinese journalist who was immediately sort of saying, oh, I flew here on my magic carpet like Aladdin. Is that what we're scared of now? And got quite huffy when you said, well, actually, I think American people are quite upset by seeing something flying over their heads. And maybe Chinese people would feel equally upset if there was an American spy balloon over their heads.
Well, China's foreign ministry spokesperson, Mao Ning, was asked by a reporter at a press conference about the second balloon still flying over Latin America. David, what's being said there?
So she's saying that you're asking about this balloon over Latin America, and we have investigated, and it is an unmanned airship. It's civilian. It's being used for flight tests, but unluckily, the weather meant that it veered off course, which American listeners will be familiar with, because that's the argument they used for their American balloon. So it's all kind of, you know, nothing to see, move along here.
Yes, so it seemed, David, in the weeks leading up to all these incidents, as if China had been trying to cool tensions with the United States, not heat them up. Is there any evidence to suggest hardline elements in the leadership or military were trying to sabotage the visit by Secretary of State Antony Blinken?
It's a really good question. And for the moment, it's almost impossible to answer for the simple reason that there are just some really big mysteries. So mystery one is, was this spy balloon so kind of capable and useful that it was worth taking a kind of deliberate risk for the Chinese to sail it right over America? So were they kind of taking a calculated risk because the rewards were there? Is it possible that there are hardliners who somehow think they can do an end run around Xi Jinping? It has to be said that at the moment, Xi Jinping's control of the security apparatus here does seem pretty close to total, with the caveat that Chinese elite politics is a black box, and we never know exactly what's going on inside. But we've seen no sign that there are PLA commanders who think that they can challenge Xi Jinping or do something that he would not want.
Yeah, so just go a little deeper into that black box. I mean, what is the likelihood that this incident began without Xi Jinping's blessings?
When the top Chinese diplomat currently in Washington, their chargé d'affaires, was summoned by the State Department and, you know, read the riot act and told this is absolutely outrageous, this thing is hovering over sensitive nuclear sites, I am told by Americans who I think know what they're talking about that he looked completely flabbergasted and was essentially useless in terms of trying to resolve this. So it's not terribly surprising that the Chinese foreign ministry was not in the loop on a sort of national security question. But that's evidence that at least some parts of the Chinese government really didn't know that this was happening. The Chinese have it in their power to escalate or to kind of calm this whole tension. You know, if we start seeing the Chinese saying, you know, we demand that we be given the balloon back and don't you dare look at it, or if they say, you know, we want to have financial compensation or you've broken international law, or if they really start pounding the propaganda drums, if we start seeing, you know, bits of this spy balloon being hauled up on land by the US Navy and sort of divers. So far, they are playing this down. It doesn't seem to suit them to escalate it. So, Marco, you'll notice that I'm answering every question except the main question you've asked me, which is, what does Xi Jinping know? That's because I have just enough self-respect as a foreign correspondent to know that I have no idea what Xi Jinping decides on a given day. This is an unbelievably secretive system, and I've asked plenty of people. Nobody knows.
So, David, just kind of pulling out a second, my understanding is that the U.S. and China surveil each other all the time, especially through satellites. Why is this balloon or these balloons setting off the chain of events we've seen in the past few days?
The party leadership here didn't seem to get it that quickly. They didn't seem to get that for the American public and for the American political establishment, the fact that this thing was visible overhead was a big deal. That they kept kind of, you know, nitpicking about why are you taking this thing so seriously. And I think that that just involves a lack of empathy, because if there were an American spy balloon floating over the middle of China and Chinese people could see it, I think you'd see a pretty strong reaction from Chinese public opinion. And so that kind of tin ear when it comes to public opinion, and that tin ear that China has for the opinion of elected politicians in Congress, I think reflects that they come from a system where the public does what it's told and the propaganda machine tells them what to think. And there are no opposition parties to make trouble for the president. And so they're just bad at reading how democracies respond to things.
So let's talk about the likely fallout or possible fallout. I mean, if the U.S. military can demonstrate this balloon was used for espionage, does that mean a total derailment of any cooperation? And don't even talk about Secretary Blinken rescheduling a trip to Beijing.
If you're an optimist, this is a good wake-up call for them to realize they need to actually start talking about crisis management. If you're a pessimist, it's a vision of how the two sides can't even agree on basic facts, and the nationalist forces on both sides make it very difficult for the two sides to back down. And the next thing that the Chinese are exceptionally focused on is whether the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, fulfills his promise that he will visit Taiwan, the island that China claims for its own. Any number of Chinese scholars you talk to say if there's a speaker visit soon, then the relationship is going to go into a really rapid downward spiral. I think that if you watch the U.S.-China relationship closely, we've had a kind of glimpse of a kind of weird mini version of what could be a unbelievably difficult and dangerous crisis.
There was this memo by an American four-star general recently leaked. It says the U.S. and China are likely going to be at war by 2025 over Taiwan. Are Chinese officials also making that kind of warning?
No, and they're very, very unhappy about the number of four stars who've been saying things with kind of dates on. The Chinese basically think that the Americans are tearing up the status quo that kept the peace over the Taiwan Straits for several decades. They think that the Americans are somehow kind of pushing for war. The Americans think the exact opposite. They think it's the Chinese who are tearing up the fragile status quo that's kept the peace. And that is itself a really dangerous dynamic, because each side thinks that it is behaving responsibly and the other side is the one that is calling for war. But the one kind of shred of hope that I cling to is that I don't hear the propaganda machine kind of cranking up the hatred of Taiwan that you would need to kind of launch a war soon.
Worrying for sure, but we will hang on to that glimmer of hope, David. David Rennie is the Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist and joined us today from the Chinese capital. Thanks as always, David.
Thank you.
More stories from around the globe ahead in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. In Singapore, a guy asks a woman for a date. She says no. Familiar story, until the guy lawyers up.
The crux of the main suit is that she traumatized him so much by rejecting him that he couldn't adequately maintain his business.
That story and a look at a big push to get plastic trash out of the ocean, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. When corruption was uncovered within Ukraine's defense ministry, the government of President Volodymyr Zelensky took swift action. It fired Ukraine's deputy defense minister, a man at the center of the graft, to start with. But anti-corruption advocates expected more accountability. After all, the shady dealings occurred on the watch of the defense minister himself, Oleksiy Reznikov. Well, now he is set to be replaced. For more on this, we reached out to Maria Zolkina, a regional security expert at the London School of Economics. I asked her what it took to finally get the defense minister dismissed weeks after the corruption scandal first emerged.
The problem is that the story with anti-corruption initiatives has nothing in common, actually, with the thinking about replacing Reznikov with another person. So it's one of the arguments to save the reputation of the ministry, but at the same time, there are some political motivations.
Well, in this case, if it's not about fighting corruption, what is it about?
So there were no evidence that this minister, I mean, Reznikov, was directly involved in one of these schemes. This is like one of the arguments. But at the same time, it's much more important who can replace him, because it will explain, like, if there is a political logic behind the decision, or it's just technocrats' decision to change the people in charge of the ministry.
Gotcha. Well, politically, as you say, there is that story to tell. As for Reznikov getting fired, I mean, not ideal or a great look for a government that is fighting a war, seeing its defense minister fired. Who is Reznikov's replacement?
Kirill Budanov. He is the head of main intelligence directorate in the Ministry of Defense. He is one of several people, or actually maybe the most famous when it comes to media, both domestic and international media, because usually absolute majority of our military staff are not very active when it comes to informational campaigns. They do not comment very often. They don't push for any informational agenda to support their work. Because usually it's like in Ukrainian political system, the civilian person should lead, because Minister of Defense has nothing with the decisions regarding the battlefield, regarding the warfare strategies. This is the civilian manager who is responsible for public procurement, for supporting the army with weapons supply, for negotiations and other types of, you know, bringing everything necessary to the army. He's manager. He doesn't necessarily need to be a military guy.
Now, Reznikov and his deputy were fired in the name of a corruption crackdown, which is crucial to keeping up the trust of Western allies, who surely don't want to send billions of dollars worth of supplies only to see it mismanaged or stolen. How much of this latest move, sacking the defense minister, is to show Western allies that Ukraine is serious about corruption?
So generally, a reaction, like a rapid reaction to some corruption cases, it's a good, let's say, public decision, because Ukraine is not hiding it. And once something is discovered, so there is a reaction both when it comes to human resources and public system generally. So people are defined, the investigations are started, because nothing is completed just if you fire someone. But the investigation should be completed, and these cases, once with good evidence, should be brought to the court.
I'm thinking about how corruption thrives when there's a lack of transparency, but at the same time, secrecy is important to any war effort. Is that a challenge for rooting out corruption in the defense ministry right now?
I think that taking into account that the war is going on, so some of the, especially public procurement schemes, they will be not hidden anymore. So at least these cases which were disclosed, they show that not everything should be under the state secrecy, let's say. And some issues like, for instance, food supply or even some kind of weapon supply to Ukraine, they should be made public and it should be visible. So how, where, and for what kind of price is something purchased?
Maria, do you know how the Ukrainian public sees the firing of the defense minister, and what does it do to the high morale of much of Ukraine?
While anti-corruption activists are absolutely happy that Reznikov can be fired, expert communities in Ukraine is very cautious about what are the risks behind changing Reznikov for someone else.
Maria Zolkina is a regional security expert at the London School of Economics, where she's a research fellow. Maria, thank you very much for explaining all this.
Thank you.
In Iran, the government has announced a mass pardon. Thousands of prisoners are expected to be released, among them people who have been rounded up in protests that began in September last year, following the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini for violating the country's so-called morality laws. Ali Vaez is following this. He's the director of the Iran Project and a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group. We should say, Ali, that there's a lot that remains unclear with this announcement, but do we know what types of prisoners might actually be released?
It appears that it includes a broad range of prisoners, including political prisoners and some of the protesters that came to the streets in the past few months. In some ways, this is both significant and routine. Routine because usually in the run-up to occasions like anniversary of the revolution, which is coming up in the next few days, and the Persian New Year in March, the Supreme Leader does issue pardons, and usually does so in large numbers.
Is it surprising that protesters will likely be included in this release? I mean, these are people who have captured the globe's imagination and really brought unprecedented scorn on the regime in Iran.
That's right. Apparently, there are some conditionality attached to the pardons. If the protesters have not been involved in acts of violence or the vaguely formed accusation of enmity with God, and apparently there's also the requirement that protesters sign official documents committing not to participate in protests again and expressing regret for their participation in protests in the past few months. So it's not as straightforward as it appears on the surface. But again, it is a sign that the regime believes that in the confrontation between the state and the society, it has prevailed.
So you said there's a history of these sorts of pardons in Iran. Is this one especially different and sort of, in that sense, also carefully managed?
It's not fundamentally different. It's just that it's coming at a time that the protests have started to slow down in Iran as a result primarily of the regime's repression. And I think this is a signal by the regime that it's turning a corner and it basically repression has won the day. But again, I'm not sure if it's going to have the intended result, because what we have seen in Iran is that protests are often not one-off developments. They are a cycle, and they're becoming much more frequent. And every time that they occur, they're becoming much more ferocious.
In other Iran news, Ali, and as the Iranian regime continues to dig its heels in against the West, we see the headline that Russia has announced it plans to build a drone factory in Iran. Does that bring Iran closer into the Ukraine conflict directly?
The drone factory is not going to be an immediate factor in the conflict dynamics. It would take at least a year or two for the factory to be built and become operational. What is right now making a difference is Iran's transfer of drones to Russia, which could potentially be compounded with transfer of ballistic missiles as well. And this is why increasingly in the eyes of Europeans, Iran is a belligerent in Russia's war against Ukraine.
How will that complicate things moving down the road as Iran and the West, meaning the US, the EU, NATO, as they continue to stare each other down?
Well, it appears that in this decoupling between the West and the East, Iran is going to be increasingly dragged into Russia and China's camp. And this, of course, creates a series of serious security concerns for U.S.'s allies in the region. Already, Iran is transferring its know-how of circumventing Western sanctions to the Russians, and this coalition of sanctioned countries could potentially create a dent in the effectiveness of this tool of foreign policy that the West is increasingly using.
Ali Vaez is the director of the Iran Project and a senior advisor to the International Crisis Group. He joined us from Washington. Ali, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
The Grammy Awards brought an extra dose of glitter to Los Angeles last night. Artists from across the globe took to the stage, starting off with Bad Bunny, who opened the night with a performance entirely in Spanish. The world's Bianca Hillier has more details.
Bad Bunny kicked off the night singing a medley of hits from his record-breaking album, Un Verano Sin Ti. The album was the first entirely Spanish-language nominee for Album of the Year. Last night, it lost out to British pop star Harry Styles, but the nomination alone is a major acknowledgement of Latin music's growth and dominance in the U.S. Bad Bunny did take home the trophy for Best Musica Urbana Album, though.
Tu Puerto Rico, la cuna y la capital del reggaetón en el mundo entero.
In his acceptance speech, which was almost entirely in Spanish, he dedicated the win to his home territory, Puerto Rico, calling it the reggaeton capital of the world. Another artist whose speech stole the show is German pop singer Kim Petras. She won Best Pop Duo Performance alongside the UK's Sam Smith.
Sam graciously wanted me to accept this award because I'm the first transgender woman to win this award.
Petras got a standing ovation and went on to thank the late Scottish music producer, Sophie, for helping pave the way for herself and other trans musicians. Then there's Anita, a singer who was up for Best New Artist. But in her home country of Brazil, Anita has been popular for years. Anita first topped the Brazilian charts in 2013, and her nomination last night marked the country's first Grammy nomination in 5 decades. On the red carpet, she said that's what matters to her.
We're making history. My whole country is watching in Brazil, waiting for this. Yeah. I'm really happy. For me, the victory is to be here tonight.
Other international artists also shouted out people back home, including South Africa's Zakes Bantwini. He's part of the group that won Best Global Music Performance for their song, Baete.
We're coming from Africa and for South Africa. And this moment right here to anybody who's in Africa just proves and affirms that every dream is valid. Every child in a ghetto, in a village, just knows it's possible.
Arguably the centerpiece of the night, though, was the show's epic celebration of hip-hop. The genre turns 50 this year, and dozens of its biggest artists took the Grammy stage to pay tribute. LL Cool J closed it out by highlighting hip-hop's prevalence around the world.
It started in the Bronx, and ever since it's gone everywhere, to the five boroughs, to the West Coast, to the heartland, overseas, to Europe, to Africa, to Asia, TikTok, whatever's next.
He added that thanks to the artists on the stage, hip-hop continues to be a global platform today. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
It is a legal case that's raising eyebrows, and this week the opening arguments begin in a Singapore court where a man is suing a woman for refusing to date him. He wants more than $2 million for his, quote, emotional distress. Women's rights groups in Singapore are calling this legal harassment. They say judges should never have allowed the lawsuit to get as far as a courtroom. The World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen is following what's going on. It honestly sounds like something out of a second-rate comedy, Patrick. What's the story behind this lawsuit?
It concerns two people, a man and a woman, and they never dated. They were just friends. The guy pressured the woman to become romantic partners, and she said, "I'm not interested," and also, "Let's not hang out so much anymore." That was all in 2020, according to legal filings, and the guy threatened to sue her for emotional distress and said the only way she could prevent getting sued is by going to therapy with him to talk about his trauma. So she put up with that for a year and a half before saying enough, and that's when he really sued her. So he's suing her twice here, actually in two different courts. But the crux of the main suit is that she traumatized him so much by rejecting him that he couldn't adequately maintain his business, which is racing drones. So the courts will hear that case on Thursday.
Wow. I mean, I got to say, this sounds crazy. I mean, what is the expected outcome with this case? Could the man potentially win?
Well, he will probably lose. Legal experts in Singapore say you have to have a solid claim for damages, like a violated business contract. He does not have that. You hurt my feelings is probably not a valid claim. One of his suits was already thrown out for that reason. A magistrate court said this is all groundless and a calculated attempt to compel engagement from the woman. That's the smaller case. The bigger case is the one coming this week. But Marco, even if he loses, what this case shows to people in Singapore is the legal system will apparently accommodate a frivolous lawsuit like this, and you can use the courts to badger someone because they won't date you.
So, Patrick, I know women's rights groups in Singapore are furious that the case got this far. Human rights advocates generally in Singapore, what are they saying about the larger ramifications of this kind of legal case?
Yeah, so there's one women's rights group that's quite prominent in Singapore called AWARE, and they've said that this case is a shocking example of male entitlement, that women do not owe men their time and attention, much less friendship and love. That's a quote. Others are pointing out that Singapore's government highlights gender rights as a major problem, and yet its courts are providing a venue for this gender-based harassment suit. So if he does win, again, that's very unlikely, women will have to worry about copycat cases. If he doesn't, perhaps somebody might take a swing at this too. And in the meantime, the woman in this case is now countersuing the man for just $1,000, and that's just to cover home security cameras, because she says with this guy out there, she does not feel safe at home.
So if this case gets thrown out as expected, does that smooth things in terms of gender and the law in Singapore?
I'm not so sure. Somebody else could bring such a case forward and tie up the person that rejected them in the courts. This is what this guy has succeeded in doing. Even if he loses the case, he's drawing more attention from this woman. That's what some of the rights groups have pointed out. So it doesn't guarantee that somebody else couldn't attempt to do this again.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thanks very much. Crazy story.
Thanks, Marco.
12 years ago, a 16-year-old in the Netherlands, Boyan Slat, took a diving trip to Greece. As he snorkeled around, he was saddened by all the plastic he saw in the water. So Slat decided to dedicate his life to cleaning up the plastic in the ocean, all of it, starting with that notorious concentration of plastic known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. More than a decade later, his organization, Ocean Cleanup, has designed a technology that is simple and efficient. A floating barrier nearly a half mile long, hanging down from it some 10 feet into the water, is a net. Trawlers slowly drag the net through the water, scooping up massive amounts of plastic trash.
It will scoop up the plastic and concentrate it. There's a big box at the end, and big box means you can put 2 Greyhound buses in there. Pull that out, and then we empty it on deck and put it back in the water.
That's Jost Dubois, the communications director for Ocean Cleanup. I interviewed him recently in front of a live audience in Thousand Oaks, California, about what the organization is trying to accomplish.
What are the results? How many tons of plastic or pounds have you been able to gather so far?
Yeah, we've been collecting almost 500,000 pounds of plastic from the ocean, but we have also 4.8 million pounds of trash that we have intercepted in rivers.
Wow. So that takes us to the next step of Ocean Cleanup, the interceptors, catching it at the source before it goes into the ocean. And what are those sources? Talk about the sources and how you've addressed that.
Yeah, we've got to be careful there. There are multiple sources, of course.
Right.
Ultimately, the source is the person that doesn't put... I mean, I shouldn't be sitting here with a plastic bottle next to me.
Making a good point. But I'm thirsty, so I'm going to drink right now.
Step one is, of course, that there is waste being generated. And for us, the source is where a river ends in the ocean. And that's where a lot of trouble start for what we are trying to solve. Mm. So we put our interceptor solutions at the end of a river, river mouth close to the ocean. The best example is here in Bayona Creek near Marina del Rey, where it's almost at the ocean. You can see it move on the waves that are coming into the creek. So an interceptor is a floating conveyor belt, basically, with a barge inside with 6 dumpsters. And that conveyor belt is fed by two barriers that lead from the shore to the mouth of the interceptor. And because of the current, the trash is being pushed towards the mouth of the conveyor belt, pull it up, dump it in the dumpsters, and when it's full, it sends a text message to the operator, like, come and empty me.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how many interceptors are there around the world right now?
We currently have 10 rivers where we have an interceptor solution. And
name a couple of the places where...
We have 2 in Malaysia, 1 in Indonesia, 1 in Vietnam. We announced 1 in Thailand that will come in on stream this year. We have 1 in the Dominican Republic. We have 4 in Jamaica, 1 in Guatemala, and 1 in the United States.
Right. Yeah,
down the road here.
There are a lot of rivers in the world. How many of them are you going to be able to put interceptors into?
Yeah. You know how many rivers there are in the world?
Well, I know that you're looking at 1,000 of them, but I'm sure there are a lot more than 1,000 rivers.
That's about 1% of all rivers in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. So there are 100,000 rivers in the world, and 1,000 of them represent 80% of all the plastic that ends up in the ocean. So our ambition is to 80-20 rule, Pareto.
Yeah.
We're going to do 1,000. Yeah. Yeah. We're at 10 now.
What kind of reception have you gotten from governments when you ask governments that, hey, you should really put one of these at, you know, the mouth of the river leading into X ocean? What do they say?
We're still waiting for those calls. So we do get people that live in certain places that reach out to us every day, dozens of people asking us, oh, we want an interceptor here, here, here. Demand from that side, but governments is still, that's still another thing.
Some incredible results, though, some trial and error. And I'm just wondering, as plastic continues to be produced and thrown away and consumed, what gives you hope?
I was trained to be a chemist. Don't tell anybody. And I worked in the plastics industry for 25 years. I know there's a lot of development going on in materials development. I see a lot of traction to change stuff. The awareness in how we use packaging is growing very rapidly. I think that is really important.
I just have to ask you one last thing. What happens to all the plastic that you've collected?
We bring the plastic we take out of the ocean back to shore, and that is recycled. The material in rivers is much more complicated. That's a mixed bag of everything. Dirty diapers, noodle containers, plastic bottles, toys, couches, fridges, syringes. That stuff is very much depending on where we are working. Here in California, the catch is sorted into 17 different categories. It's important to understand that the smaller pieces all have to be selected by hand. It's incredibly expensive. It's high-intensity work. And it's great that people are willing to do it. It's not nice work either. We are setting up, together with Coca-Cola, these kind of sorting centers in the Dominican Republic, in Malaysia, in Guatemala as well, and at least avoid that stuff that can be reutilized is ending up in a landfill or being incinerated.
Yosu Wah, Communications Director for the Ocean Cleanup, thank you so much for being with us, for making the trip, for telling us about the work that you do. Thank you.
Our conversation with Yosu Wah from Ocean Cleanup was part of the world's recent stage show with public radio station KCLU at the Schur Forum Theater in Thousand Oaks, California. Returning to today's top story, a powerful 7.8 magnitude earthquake hit southern Turkey as people were asleep early this morning. Hours later, another quake, 7.5 magnitude. The death toll is rising dramatically. Thousands of people are dead and many thousands more are injured or missing. More than 20 countries are sending search and rescue experts. The affected area is on Turkey's border with Syria, a region that has been traumatized by war and conflict for more than a decade. Many of the people affected by the earthquakes live in regions with large populations of refugees and displaced people. Tomorrow on The World, we'll be back with ongoing coverage of the quakes, the damage, and relief efforts. That is where we say goodbye on this Monday. We're always available online at theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.